Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 8th of March. Only 26% of guests on the Sunday AM talk shows are women. That was a figure from 2013, and men are 3.4 times more likely to be quoted on the front page of the New York Times. We're in the middle of a very big election cycle, presidential race, and our guest asked the question, why are political experts mostly men? Women also know stuff. We have two guests with us for this hour's conversation, Professor Kathleen Searles, Assistant Professor of Political Communication and at Louisiana State University, and Professor Emily Beaulieu, who is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Kentucky. They wrote an interesting piece at theconversation.com which caught our attention, and as a result of their looking at this issue, there is now a site that's available. It's an accessible database of women experts in political science, so people who are booking shows all over the country can look at this list and get more women on the air. We're going to be welcoming phone calls. We'll also take a little look at the race with our political science experts because they're with us, and there's a lot to discuss on that front as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Kathleen Searles, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. And Professor Emily Beaulieu, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, thanks.
Hi, yeah, our pleasure. We should have fun. All right, women academics, you both write, have often been missing in the conversations that are important as we elect a new president. The question is, why? Kathleen or Katie?
Sure. So we write a lot about this in this piece and in other pieces. For example, we had a Huffington Post article come out today as well, if your readers are and listeners are interested. But there's a couple of areas of obstacle for women experts. Promotion and tenure is one of them. They're less likely to be cited. And all of this amounts to we're also less likely to hear from them in the media. And when we're less likely to hear from women in the media, people are less likely to perceive women as experts. And this whole sort of leaky pipeline continues.
Mm-hmm. You want to add to that, Professor Beaulieu?
Absolutely. So in addition to the gender gaps that we see in rates of tenure on publication in top journal outlets and citations, there's this other issue that women academics confront that has to do with folks' biases about who women are and how they should behave. And so one of the places we see this really clearly is in student evaluations of teaching, where women who are evaluated at rates similar to their male peers have achieved that often by needing to conform to gendered stereotypes. They're more open, they're more available, they're more nurturing to their students. And not only does that come with a cost of extra time and effort, which can impinge on research activities, but those same qualities undermine perceptions of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's this double bind of both the sort of objective measures that we see, but then the ways that women have to navigate society's biases.
This figure is interesting to me, that women earn 40% of the PhDs in political science. That's almost half the PhDs.
Yeah, it's true. And yet, women are less likely to obtain promotion with tenure, which is sort of the first major academic hurdle that we face once achieving a PhD. And then there are fewer women who attain the rank of full professor, but in large part because of that first difficulty obtaining tenure. And the real irony of it is, if you look at some of the work that folks like Sarah Mitchell and Vicki Hesley have done at University of Iowa, is even when we control for things that we think should affect tenure, like how many publications you have, how old are you, we still see an effect of gender beyond the factors that we sort of, quote-unquote, should matter
mm-hmm.
in the promotion.
Well, let's talk more about what those are. What are they?
What are the factors that were the unobservables? Well, this is where it comes into, again, I would argue, perceptions of bias, because in addition to things like how much are you producing, we often get assessed scholars in terms of how good is their work, how important is their work, right? And here we can look to the research that's been done on differential rates of citation, where in the field of international relations is where this has been studied most specifically, that subfield of political science, not only do we see that an article authored by a woman gets about 20% fewer citations than articles authored by men, again, controlling for a whole lots of things like what journal it was published in, how long since it was published, etc. But when that same data is subject to a network analysis, what shows up very clearly is that women get cited less by those works that are seen as subsequently most influential. Mm. And so these feed into perceptions that maybe you're doing the same amount of work as a male colleague, but your work's not going to be seen as influential or important.
Mm. Does any of this, or is this way off base, have to do with the whole field of political science, the institutions that you're covering, the presidential races that you're covering, your analysis is a field that has tended to be dominated by men, and so somehow there's a perception that men can handle the rough and tumble, mostly male world of politics better than women can?
Sure. I think that is a part of it, right? Because we do know that, for example, people perceive politicians to be males and often ascribe the sort of characteristics we would want politicians to have, like competence, confidence, authority, leadership. They often also ascribe those same traits to males. And so I think that is part of what the obstacle for perceiving women as being authorities on discussing the political environment, on discussing elections. And also, I think politics in general, as you say, is seen as rough and tumble. It's seen as an aggressive sport. It's the horse race, right? And men are fight it out in that domain. And oftentimes the perception might be that women aren't part of that, that women are at home maybe thinking about how they might vote, but aren't exactly a part of that public discourse. And we're hoping to correct that.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at this, because we're so much a world of what we watch on television and who the experts are on television. I think that they just don't go to much of the country to find experts. It's the same people all the time. But this figure is pretty remarkable. 26% of guests on Sunday talk shows, AM talk shows, women in the year 2013. When there are so many women who are political analysts, is it just that you're not on the Rolodex or what?
I think that reference to the Rolodex is a large part of what we think is going on. We have, in a few venues, really wanted to make clear that we don't think there are active or overt efforts to exclude women at work here. It's just the notion that you've got, you know, a week to put a show together and probably in a big time crunch. And so when you need experts, you rely on your network. And what we know about humans is that they tend to associate most with people who are like them.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it's men who are predominantly putting the shows together, then it's likely to be men that they know to have expertise. And so I think it's just these network effects that are pervasive and very powerful, even if they're largely inadvertent.
I think I also notice it, and I'd like to do a study of this at some point, but I've been doing talk shows for a long time and love politics, and we do a huge number of political discussions on this program. It's a call-in show. You'll hear from listeners in a little while. I would say that it's probably 70% males who call into this to talk about politics, and I've always wondered why that's the case. What do you think, Emily?
Well, I think that issue of voluntary participation is really important and sort of selecting into this environment. Katie mentioned earlier the perceptions of politics as highly competitive, and one thing we know from studies is that women do tend to shy away from competitive environments relative to men.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that these biases, I think we're not immune to these biases ourselves, right? I think that the idea that there's something sort of more distasteful about putting yourself out there to express opinions and offer expertise as a woman is something that even women themselves have to confront. It's not just that that's something sort of society perceives to be the case. I think your observation about who's calling into your show is totally consistent with these trends that we're seeing and the extent to which sort of everyone in society comes to absorb them. And I think really one of the things we're hoping to do with our website, in addition to providing a searchable list of women experts so that folks can't say, gosh, I didn't know there were women working on X. I think we're also hoping to convince more women, like, you are an expert. You can do this. You can put yourself out there in the media and communicate your knowledge to the public.
By all means. Katie, what do you say in this?
Yeah, so there's some really interesting work done by Jennifer Lawless and some others that looks at why women run for office. And they show that even at early ages, women, young girls are socialized to think that, you know, being a politician is not something women do. It's not something girls aspire to. And that when women reach the ranks where they might consider running for public office, they often feel like they're less competent or that they need more experience, more qualifications than a male colleague might think that they need before they run for office. And we see that same sort of thing repeated in academia where, for example, a recent research showed that female economists are less likely to speak on areas that are outside their expertise confidently, whereas their male colleagues might feel more comfortable speaking on a range of topics outside their immediate research area. And this goes back to what the implicit biases Emily was speaking of, where we sort of assume or we have these sort of automatic notions that we aren't capable or competent in these areas, and when you don't see women in the public sphere, it reinforces those notions.
Mm, interesting. So it's almost like scientists, because what you're saying, a lot of people have said about scientists, that they feel that they can't talk if they're a global warming expert, they don't want to talk about water issues, and they have to be very careful about making statements about one thing or another unless there's universal acceptance of an idea. It almost sounds like that, doesn't it?
It is similar, and I think your point about the comparison to the sciences reminds me of a couple of minutes ago when you asked if maybe what's going on in political science has to do with what we study, the fact that we study politics. But I think actually more and more we hear stories of women across the social and natural sciences who are in very similar situations where there are these big gaps in who is perceived to be the expert doing the interesting research on the cutting edge that very often track along gender lines.
Mm-hmm. Does it make a difference? I know this is a general question, but I'm sure you'll take a stab at it. Does it make a difference? And if so, what is the difference in terms of where a conversation goes? If you had a Sunday morning panel on television or wherever that was representative of the population, in other words, if you had more women and more minorities, not just make it male dominated, what's the difference?
Yeah, I think that we miss something when we leave out, you know, half the population from these conversations. For example, there's been really great efforts by groups like Foreign Policy Interrupted to bring attention to the fact that women are often left out of foreign policy conversations. And because of that, we see less discussion of things like peace, despite the fact that we know that research shows us that when women are involved in negotiations about peace talks, that they're more likely to last longer. Also, we know that women are more likely to bring up and highlight issues that are of interest and concern to women, whereas those issues often get left out of public discourse when women are not part of the picture.
Mm-hmm. I think another thing to consider is that sometimes by not including women, you're actually missing the foremost expert on a topic. A friend the other day forwarded me an article that was an assessment of part of this election that focused on political ideology, and the article had chosen to use an unpublished paper by two men despite the fact that there is a female scholar who has published in our top-rated journals on this very issue. And so sometimes by leaving women out, you're literally just missing sort of the best scholars in a given area.
Mm-hmm. I know that there's, and this is a good thing that I hope gets in the hands of everybody, but as a result of looking at underrepresentation in the media, you have compiled this Women Also Know Stuff database, which is terrific. How large is it? How widely is it being distributed? And was there not something like this previously?
Emily, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we have at least 1,000 or more people on the list.
We're up to over 1,000.
Really?
Thousand. Over 1,000, yeah.
The profiles.
The reaction has been just amazing, Kathleen, from women all over the world, across disciplines, just really supportive and just enthusiastic about these sort of efforts and just really underscoring what we believe to be true, which is that there are a lot of women that know a lot of stuff all over that want to be part of the conversation, and if we can make it a little bit easier for people on a deadline to think about women, then we feel like we've absolutely done our part.
Mm-hmm.
And to my knowledge, so to the extent that there was anything like this before, there are databases of experts that tend to be more subject-specific. But I am aware of a database of journalists of color that was started, that was definitely sort of one of the models we had in mind when we undertook this effort. But to my knowledge, this is not a widespread availability. There's not a widespread availability of this type of resource. And in fact, I think one of our long-term goals, Katie mentioned that there are women from lots of different disciplines who want something like this, and we think it's probably beyond the scope of what we can do to provide that, but we're hoping that we can provide a pretty concrete model, a sort of how-to, if you will, for folks who would also like to undertake this specific to their particular group or particular discipline.
And then there's the other issue, I think. One of my complaints about this whole election cycle and the way that it has been for some years is we really have a need, I think, for political scientists to be engaged in the debate. It's journalists, and sometimes it's just, you know, pundits who have strong opinions and put them together in a catchy kind of way, and we see the same people on the air over and over and over, where you've got a list of 1,000 who can inform us on foreign policy and domestic policy, I'm sure, much more ably and completely than some of the people that we're seeing endlessly on television.
I don't think you'll get any disagreement from the two of us, Kathleen, that we need more political scientists in these conversations. I remember a point at which the Coburn Amendment, which was the amendment by Senator Coburn to try to strip National Science Foundation funding for the for political science, one of the arguments that was put forth at that time was, we don't really need political science research because there are journalists like Wolf Blitzer on CNN that can tell us all we need to know. And needless to say, we could not disagree more with that assessment.
Sure. We're going to welcome phone calls, and we hope we'll hear from some women during the course of this hour. Let's change that number, because it is true, and maybe you can shed light on why it is that more men call, particularly when we're doing all things political discussions, which we do every Monday. Why are political experts mostly men? Women Also Know Stuff, the focus of an article that was in The Conversation, and also our guests say it appears in Huffington Post today. We have two guests with us, and they are political scientists. Kathleen Searles is assistant professor of political communication at Louisiana State University. Professor Emily Beaulieu, associate professor of political science at the University of Kentucky. Here is our phone number. Would you like to see these panels? Would you like to see academic journals and popular publications, for that matter, be more equitably distributed between men and women? Why do you think it is that women struggle so to really be heard in the field of political science? Why is it that so many talk show guests are men? And why men are 3.4 times more likely to be quoted on the front page of the New York Times? And as we are, both our guests will respond to this more fully as we talk, as we try to dissect the many issues that are involved in this pretty wild presidential race, what is it? Who are the people you want to hear from? Would you like to have more political scientists who understand history? Yes, yesterday we had people referring to elections that took place in the 1800s, and I think for public radio audiences, we're really hungry for that kind of historical information too, which you usually don't get. Usually, it's listening to Donald Trump, to tell you the truth, speak over and over again. That's what the press is latching onto. We'd love to hear from you, so please give us a ring. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we always welcome all of your comments. And we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. More in just a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Why are political experts mostly women? Why is it mostly men who appear on television programs and on the front page of newspapers commenting on political issues? Women also know stuff, so say our guests, and they have written about it, and they are political scientists, and we're welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655. Anne in Viroqua, our first caller. Hi, Anne.
Hi. Not addressing specifically why men are shown more, but you asked the question about why do people want history or research and whatnot, and, I mean, to even be asking that on NPR, WPR, is kind of surprising, and the answer is we have 6 corporations who run the majority, the vast majority, of all the information we get, and we are not getting informed. We're just getting told what they want us to hear. There's no analysis. There's no background. And it also goes into the changes in education. We've gone away from education into training. We don't want people to get an education like we used to. A bachelor's degree is learning how to learn. It's training people for specific tasks. And, news outlets are controlled. You can't get a story. There's no investigative journalism in proportion to what there was 30 years ago. I mean, it's gone. It's over. And even NPR is beholden to their corporate sponsors. And especially Wisconsin Public Radio trying to show, quote, balanced news. I mean, where is the middle now? And that's really all I have to say. Unfortunately, it's still a sexist world. ERA did not get passed.
Thanks very much for the call in. Emily, you want to start?
So I think that the issue of who is in charge is really, really important. Who's in charge of the messages that we get? And I think one of the things we are hoping to do is to really make an appeal to the folks who are in positions of power to control what makes it onto media, to say, listen, we have a really simple, straightforward way that you can incorporate more women into your programming.
Katie?
Yeah, so it's interesting. My research looks at the intersection of politics and media, and your caller is hit on something that's really important right now, which is media ownership. And the great work of people like Joanna Dunaway at Texas A&M shows that media ownership of newspapers and media outlets is hugely important and affects the sort of content we see as readers and viewers and listeners. And so I think she's absolutely right. And lucky enough, there are political scientists, women, in fact, that are doing really great work on this and help shed some light on the kind of content we can expect when media owners as media owners coalesce their outlets.
Thanks very much for the call, Anne. Let's go to Suzanne next in Lake Geneva. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call. What I want to talk about is the fact that we have a brilliant woman running for president. And, nobody should vote for a woman because she's a woman. But we have a brilliant woman who is wonderfully qualified to be president. And all the media can talk about is, well, we shouldn't vote for her because she's a woman. You know, I mean, instead of her qualifications. And I think sometimes women do that to themselves because it's just so frustrating. And I think that's why a lot of these boards, these media boards are filled with men. It's, you know, and I'm not sure exactly why, but it is very frustrating because we finally have this brilliant woman who sees all sides of the questions, who is so capable, and yet all we can talk about is, well, we're not going to vote for her because she's a woman. Well, we've never had a woman. Let's give it a try. You know, here we finally have somebody who's so qualified. Why not vote for her? You know, I mean, and I realize there are a lot of people who, you know, don't believe that. But anyway, that's what I have to say.
Thanks, Suzanne. Thank you. Well, let's get right into it. It is a chance, a fairly good chance that we may have a female president. How does that play into, Katie, all that we're talking about? And are we spending too much time on that issue in this presidential race? How is it playing in her candidacy? How does it play in a whole discussion about the presidential race? I'd like to hear from both of you on this.
Sure. So as I mentioned earlier, one of the obstacles we see that female candidates face is that they believe they need more experience, they need a longer resume before they can run, whereas males don't often have that same sort of high standard before they run for office. And I think we see that sort of fulfilled in Hillary's run for the White House. She's highly qualified. She has great experience. Even if you don't like her, I think most people can agree that her resume is very impressive. But oftentimes we seem to be unable, at least in media coverage, to get past her gender. And the media narrative has often been, is she too aggressive? Is she too feisty? And all these other sort of very gendered words to describe her, which do have negative consequences for the way we perceive her as a leader. But the good news is that the research also shows that at the end of the day, gender matters when we think about who we want to be our leaders, but what matters more is partisanship. And so we are very much beholden to our partisanship. And most people will vote that way, regardless of gender, when it comes to Election Day.
Mm-hmm. What do you say about this?
Well, so I would take what Suzanne said. So Suzanne made the statement that we shouldn't vote for someone just because they're a woman. And I would actually say that I absolutely agree with her characterization of Hillary's qualifications, and I absolutely think it's fine to vote for someone because of a particular characteristic that they have. I think that we can't underestimate, and the research shows that there is a real importance in what we call descriptive representation, that is having people who look like you, who you feel represent who you are, not necessarily your ideology or your policy preferences, but reflect some more sort of essential characteristics of who you are, that it is actually really meaningful and important to see those people in positions of power. And so I think that it absolutely is okay to take Hillary's gender into consideration as a positive, as something that would enrich the field of who can be president.
Do you think that there is something perhaps not fair, or is it being treated fairly, her run for the presidency? Is there too much focus? I know there's been a lot of focus because all these candidates have to speak all the time, and I think all of them have kind of lost their voices or have had colds, which how could you not when you have this kind of schedule? Oh, my gosh, it's exhausting. But there has been a lot said about her tone of voice and the way that she speaks, I've noticed. Is that something that has been directed toward her because she is a female and we haven't heard as much of that? Are there other things about her candidacy that we wouldn't see mentioned, say, in a Ted Cruz run?
Yeah, so there's a couple things. First, it's really interesting you brought up her voice because there's actually really interesting research that suggests that people are more likely to think women's voices are not authoritative and also ascribe characteristics to women's voices that are not necessarily characteristics you would want if you're running for office. For example, grating or shrill is a word we hear often used in conjunction with Hillary. And that kind of perception of an authoritative voice is actually very influential in how people perceive a leader. And also our focus on how she talks and the way she talks and as if she should be more demure or
yes.
or perhaps less authoritative in her speech is really, I would say, unequal, right? Because we don't talk about Cruz or Trump as being too boisterous or too loud or too authoritative. That's just how they speak as people running for the highest office in the United States. So that kind of focus, also the focus on things like what she's wearing,
mm-hmm.
How much makeup she's wearing, her wrinkles, these sorts of things we rarely hear talked about when we talk about male candidates.
Yeah. Emily?
Well, and I think that the sort of mirror image of that is what has stood out to me in the Democratic contest is that some amount of the praise for Bernie Sanders is simply praise that Hillary would never receive because she is a woman. The one that stands out in my mind being that he only pays $8 for his haircut. There's no universe in which a woman running to be president could find an $8 haircut and expect anyone to, you know, think that was
you
a great
You remember John
thing.
Edwards with his $400?
Yes, I remember.
Right.
That got
right.
him far, yeah.
Right. And so I do think that it's as much sort of the, you know, the things that, well, and even sort of Bernie's outsider status, right? That's something that it's been largely acknowledged. There has not been enough success of female candidates for women to be able to forge a kind of outsider path and hope mm-hmm. for it to be successful.
Let's go to Ursula, who wants to comment on this hilarious voices, too, from Green Bay. Hi, Ursula.
Hi. I don't have any scientific information, but I did poll the 11 women that I had lunch with just now. And we do believe that women's voices, which are higher pitched, are less pleasing to hear on the radio and on television. In print, it doesn't matter. In the same way that my little group came up and said that men whose voices are not quite deep enough or low enough that you have to question when you hear the voice, is it a man or is it a woman, have more difficulty. I do believe, and as do my friends, that a deeper voice is just easier to listen to. And I don't know if that's because we grew up that way, that our mothers were always kind and gentle and soft-spoken, and our fathers laid down the laws. You can tell that I'm older. But that was our consensus, that it's also the voice, not how strident it is, but just the higher pitch.
Mm.
That's all I wanted
to
share.
All right, thanks, Ursula.
Yeah, she's right, actually. She's absolutely right. The little non-scientific poll of her friends at lunch, they were on to something. The physiological research shows that both men and women with voices at a lower register are more likely to be kind of favored compared to men with a higher pitch or women with a lower pitch. And not just favored, but men and women with lower pitches were more likely to be perceived as presidential quality. So really, Ursula was onto something there.
Hmm.
I would, of course, just like to play devil's advocate and
sure.
point out, on the other end of the spectrum, we have seen the rise of the phenomenon of criticizing women whose voices become too low and sort of gravelly. There was the backlash against what got called vocal fry quite recently.
Oh, yes. Right.
And so I think I absolutely agree that Katie and Ursula have nailed it in terms of the physiological responses, but I think we also notice even when women attempt deeper voices, there are still biases that kick in to at times make them seem less appealing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's something to the whole breakthrough. It's been a long, long time, if ever, in this country that we have heard one person, a female voice. We hear mostly Donald Trump these days, but we're hearing a lot of Hillary Clinton and the other candidates as well. It's been a long time since we've heard a female voice so omnipresent in this election cycle. It's something unusual, and maybe it's like entering a field for the first time. Women, it hasn't been that long since they've entered certain professions in huge numbers. So it takes some, oh, there's a different voice. There's something different. And eventually we'll get used to all of that. But we're not yet there, I don't think.
Yeah, the social contributes to these sort of implicit biases we hold, right? The more we are exposed to different voices, to different perceptions of leaders, to
yes.
different perceptions of experts, the more we'll accept that there is a diversity of opinion and that they are all deserving and it should be a part of the public discourse.
Thank you very much, Ursula, for your call. And let's go to our first male caller. How about that, ladies? John in Middleton. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm part of the senior congregation. I'm in 77. And as I grew up, we had very few, if any, role models. And so today, you know, looking for a Margaret Thatcher, we get Sarah Palin.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of Sarah Palin, John?
Kind of the female Donald Trump.
Oh. I forgot about Sarah Palin.
We'd like to.
But
my point is, because we didn't have any role models, and we're the group most likely to vote, we're not accustomed to having a lady as a role model.
Mm-hmm. Two pretty different role models, Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton. Emily, take it.
Yeah, I think that, well, and didn't Saturday Night Live make hay of those possibilities during the during that election, the contrast between the two. And in some ways, they were, Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton were really seen as these sort of archetypal roles for women to occupy, right? You could either be the shrill Hillary Clinton, sort of overly ambitious, or you could be the more airheaded, hyper-focused on appearance Sarah Palin. That seemed to be kind of the message there, right, was that was the range of choices for women in the public eye in leadership positions. I think that what we're hoping for, John, is that with our initiatives and the work of a lot of other really smart, amazing people, that we're going to reach a point soon where there will be a critical mass of role models that will offer kind of a wider variety of options for how women might assume leadership positions.
Thanks, John, for your call. Let's go to David in Rockton, Illinois. Hi, David.
Hi. Thanks for the opportunity. Let me speak. And I was gratified to hear that last comment that there is an environment where there will be a more diverse group of women to be role models and leaders. I do not admire Hillary Clinton in any respect, really. As Secretary of State, she pushed the Obama administration to invade Libya, take Gaddafi out. Once the country's destroyed and in turmoil, that's fine. Leave it, move along to Syria. And the revolution in Syria was instigated by us. And that was Hillary. In fact, she resigned as Secretary of State because we didn't bomb Syria. So that has created a huge mess in Europe. It's one of the most inhumane situations in modern history, I guess, since World War II. And that's the person that we want to elect as president. I find her disagreeable, but I also find Bernie Sanders, I don't like his accent and, you know, his age and so on, but I would vote for him. But I would not vote for Hillary. So, I think if that's the best you can do, that's a sorry commentary on your gender.
Thanks, David, very much for the call. Well, it's an interesting point. She has, at the risk of being too simplistic, but we don't have a whole lot of time here, she has been accused of being much more hawkish, and then you get into the debate of whether or not women are more concerned with peace issues. She's been put in a category of being more hawkish, which is traditionally thought of as a male quality, do you think, or not? Can we not define genders by that anymore? Emily?
I think historically,
female leadership has been seen as more interested in pursuing peace, reaching consensus. A recent graduate of the University of Kentucky, actually, who's now on faculty at Radford College in Virginia, has done research showing that, in fact, in countries where there are prolonged security threats and crises, it adds an additional barrier to women achieving leadership positions, largely in based on the assumption that they will not be as sort of aggressive in their military orientation as men.
Mm-hmm. Katie?
Yeah, so in the campaign literature, the issue of security and international affairs is perceived as being owned by men.
Mm-hmm.
Although there's conflicting research on this, there is a segment of scholars who argue that women that can artfully be more aggressive and more hawkish in their policies will garner more favor because they're being perceived as running more like men. On the other side, there is some research that says running like men does not behoove women. But again, a lot of complications there because of the sort of myriad factors that play into the campaign environment and the race.
Let's pause for a moment and return and welcome more phone calls. Why are political experts, and particularly those we see on TV or read about on the front page of our newspapers, mostly men? Women also know stuff. So say our guest this hour, Emily Baudelou, is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Kentucky. Kathleen Searles is Assistant Professor of Political Communication at Louisiana State University, and we're welcoming phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655. They've talked about how difficult it is for women in political science to reach the more advanced professorial ranks, and also that there is a real gap here, gender gap, when we look at who we go to for examination of political issues, for historical comparisons, and for deep analysis of what's going on in a political race, that most of the voices that we're hearing are men. Why is that? They have also put together this list, which will be helpful to people who are booking guests on various shows, an accessible database of women experts in political science. Women also know stuff. We have lines open now if you'd like to join our conversation. The phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, or on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. And you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Okay, let's go back to phone calls. Dan in Madison. Hi, Dan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a quick comment. I wanted to reference a guest that you had on probably a couple of years ago, but it was a woman journalist who was talking with an African envoy to the UN. And this journalist, who happened to be a woman, said, why aren't there more women in leadership positions in the UN? Why aren't there more women in political leadership positions in general? And this man, who happened to be a man, said, well, because all the women would want to do is compromise. And this journalist asked it again. He said it again. And the point that she was making when she was talking about this on this call was that sort of encapsulates it, doesn't it? So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Thank you, Dan. Interesting comment. Katie?
Yeah, and we do know that women and men are often perceived as having very different leadership styles. But it's important to note that there's a lot of data that shows that is a strength for women. For example, we know that women CEOs were better able to weather the financial collapse than men CEOs. Women CEOs are likely to have higher profit revenues. We also see all sorts of other positive characteristics for women in leadership, women in academia, women as experts. That bring different qualities, different areas of expertise, different issues to the fore that we think are important.
Yeah, I think that the characterization of women as compromisers, I mean, it's definitely a strong gender stereotype that's very consistent with, again, how students expect their female professors to behave, for example. And it is
I think, as Katie mentions, it can often be an asset. I, frankly, often feel like many of my male colleagues would benefit from a little more compromise, as would many male leaders.
Well, sure, the country is calling for that. So many people are saying, for heaven's sake, at least talk to each other and come up with something.
Yeah, Congress, it might be nice if Congress would think about compromising every once in a while. Maybe more would get done. As Margaret Thatcher said today on International Women's Day, it's appropriate to quote her, I think. She said, if you want something done, you ask a woman.
Right.
Well, yeah, and wasn't the story that with the snowstorm and the shutdown in D.C., it was the female legislators who made their way in? And
yes, it was.
I have a colleague, Tiffany Barnes, who's writing a book about women's legislative behavior, and in that she has a great story about how negotiations on the budget crisis here in the U.S. a few years ago, when they were so stalled, it was really women's committees in the Senate and House that got things moving again.
Mm. We did have, because we're heavily into a campaign season, and I thought about this when the person said it, the person who called who was complaining about Hillary Clinton and saying she resigned because we didn't go to war in Syria. I think she left because she was probably tired and had enough, and she was thinking that, you know, she's going to run for president. I don't think it had anything to do with not going to war in Syria. Would you like to confirm that or disagree?
It's hard to kind of infer intentions from afar, but certainly it is not unusual for secretaries of state to serve only one term with a president. And in fact, there's quite a bit of precedent in former administrations to that effect. So I don't think it was unusual for her to resign at that point. But who knows exactly what was going on in the mind of the secretary?
Yeah.
I think this is one, Kathleen, that you will need a few years' distance and then some historical analysis.
All right. Will you be on our show?
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to Bill in Milwaukee. Hi, Bill.
Hi there.
Hi.
I wanted to just say thank you to your guests today, but obviously I'm a male. And I think one of the critical points that you're kind of generalizing, which is not accurate, I think perhaps paralleling your earlier male callers, that I think there are many men out there that would vote for any female. It's just not this particular female, Hillary Clinton. I think when you talk about her being qualified and her qualifications and accomplishments, I think they're a little bit skinny, consistent with that earlier caller. And I think the tone of voice and their stature and ability to compromise, et cetera, is probably second or third derivative compared to what their message is that they're delivering. You look at the candidates, you know, Carly Fiorina, the Sheryl Sandberg from Facebook, or the leader of GM. Those are all very capable women with different voice tenors, et cetera, but they're delivering different messages. And again, the male, I don't think, is afraid for not voting a female. It's just not that female, Hillary Clinton.
All right. Thanks,
I'll take
Bill.
The rest of my comments off the air.
Thanks. I think your comment is going to be the last comment that we hear because we are out of time. Thank you so much. We certainly will look for that whole list of female experts, although we do our best to get a wide range of voices on this particular show and on this network, actually. But we'll look for your list of women who know stuff. And thank you, Kathleen and Emily, very much for being with us. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Kathleen.
Yeah, our pleasure. Professor Kathleen Searles, Assistant Professor of Political Communication at Louisiana State University. Professor Emily Beaulieu, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Kentucky. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and tomorrow we're going to be exploring some disturbing information about attempts to deny civil rights to LGBT citizens. There have been a number of anti-LGBT laws passed, and we'll talk about those tomorrow during this particular time period. Please listen.